Chapter 30. They hit us less than 2 seconds after we cast into the system, the torch ships and archangels converging fire on us, much as the rainbow sharks had once converged on me in the seas of Mare Infinitus. "Go!" cried the true voice of the tree, Hetmastine, above the torrent of field noise around us. "The Urgs are dying. The containment field will drop in seconds. Go! May the Muir guide your thoughts. Go!" Anea had had only 2 seconds to glimpse the yellow star at the center of Pacham's system, and the smaller star that was Pacham proper, but it was enough. The three of us held hands as we cast through light and noise, as if rising through the cauldron of lance fire boiling the ship's fields, spirits rising from hell's burning lakes. The light faded, and then resumed as diffuse sunlight. It was cloudy above the Vatican, chilly, almost wintry, and a light, cool rain fell on cobblestone streets. Anea had dressed this day in a soft tan shirt, a brown leather vest, and more formal black trousers than I was used to seeing her wear. Her hair was brushed back and held in place by 2 tortoiseshell barrettes. Her skin looked fresh and clean and young, and her eyes, so tired in recent days, were bright and calm. She still held my hand as the three of us turned to look at the streets and people around us. We were at the edge of an alley looking onto a wide boulevard. Small groups of people, men and women in formal black, groups of priests, flocks of nuns, a row of children in tow behind 2 nuns, everywhere black and red umbrellas, moved to and fro on the pedestrian walkways while low black ground cars glided silently down the streets. I caught a glimpse of bishops and archbishops in the back seats of the ground cars, their visages distorted by beads and rivulets of rain on the car's bubble tops. No one seemed to be taking any notice of us or our arrival. Anea was looking up toward the low clouds. "The Yggdrasil just cast out of system. Did either of you feel it?" I closed my eyes to concentrate on the dream flow of voices and images that were ever under the surface there now. There was an absence, a vision of flame as the outer branches began to burn. "The fields collapsed just as they cast away," I said. "How do they cast without you, Anea?" I saw the answer as soon as I had verbalized the question. "The Shrike," I said. "Yes." Anea was still holding my hand. The rain was cold on us, and I could hear it gurgling down gutters and drain pipes behind us. She spoke very quietly. "The Shrike will carry the Yggdrasil and the true voice of the tree away through space and time, to his destiny." I remembered bits of the Kantos. The tree ship burning as the pilgrims watched from the sea of grass, shortly before Hetmastine had mysteriously disappeared with the Shrike during the wind wagon crossing. Then the Templar reappearing in the presence of the Shrike some days later near the Valley of the Time Tombs, dying from his wounds shortly after that. His tale the only one of the 7 pilgrims not to be told on the voyage. The Hyperion pilgrims, Colonel Cassad, the Hegemony consul, Saul, Rachel's father, Braun Lamia, Anea's mother, the Templar Hetmastine, Martin Silenus, Father Hoyt, the current pope. All at a loss to explain events at the time. For me as a child, just old words from a myth, verses about strangers. How they must have thought their efforts and adventures over, only to have to pick up their burdens again. How often, I realized now as an adult in my standard 30s, how often that is the case in all of our lives. "See that church across the street?" said Father DeSoya. I had to shake my head to focus on the now and to ignore the thoughts and voices whispering to me. "Yeah," I said, wiping the rain from my brow. "Is that St. Peter's Basilica?" "No," said the priest. "That is St. Anne's Parish Church, and the entrance to the Vatican next to it is the Porta Sant' Anna. The main entrance to St. Peter's Square is down the boulevard there and around those colonnades."
"Are we going to St. Peter's Square?" I asked Anea. "Into the Vatican?"
"Let's see if we can," she said. We started down the pedestrian walkway. Just a man and a younger woman walking with a priest on a cool, rainy day. Across the street from us was a sign indicating that the imposing windowless structure there was the barracks for the Swiss Guard.
troopers from that barracks, in formal Renaissance-era black cloaks, white ruffled collars, and yellow and black leggings, stood holding pikes at the Puerta Santa Ana and at the intersections, while PAC security police in no-nonsense black impact armor manned roadblocks and floated overhead in black skimmers. St. Peter's Square was closed off to foot traffic, except for several security gates, where guards were carefully checking passes and chip card IDs. "We won't get through there," said Father De Soya. It was dark enough that the lights had come on atop Bernini's colonnade to illuminate statuary and the stone papal coats of arms there. The priest pointed to two windows glowing above the colonnade, and to the right of St. Peter's facade, topped by statues of Christ, John the Baptist, and the Apostles. "Those are the Pope's private offices." "Just a rifle shot away," I said, although I had no thoughts of attacking the Pope. Father De Soya shook his head. "Class 10 containment field." He glanced around. Much of the pedestrian traffic had passed through the security gates into St. Peter's Square, and we were becoming more obvious on the street. "We're going to get our ID checked if we don't do something," he said.
"Is this level of security common?" asked Ania.
"No," said Father De Soya. "It may be because of your message that you were coming, but it is more probable that it is the usual security when His Holiness is saying a papal mass. Those bells we heard were a call to an afternoon mass at which he is presiding." "How do you know that?" I said, amazed that he could read so much from the sound of a few bells. Father De Soya looked surprised. "I know that because it is Holy Thursday," he said, looking shocked either because we did not know such an elementary fact or because he had managed to forget it until this moment.
"This is Holy Week," he went on, talking softly as if to himself. "All this week His Holiness must carry out both his papal and diocesan duties. Today, this afternoon, certainly at this Mass, he performs the ceremony of washing the feet of 12 priests who symbolize the 12 disciples whose feet Jesus washed at the Last Supper. The ceremony was always held at the Pope's diocese church, the Basilica of St. John Lateran, which used to be beyond the Vatican walls. But ever since the Vatican was moved to Pochum, it's been held in St. Peter's Basilica. The Basilica of St. John Lateran was left behind during the Hegira because it had been destroyed during the Seven Nation Wars in the 21st century, and..." De Soya stopped what I had thought was nervous chatter. His face had gone blank in that way common to mild epileptics or deeply thoughtful people. Ania and I waited. I admit that I was glancing with some anxiety toward the patrol of black-armored PAC security men moving toward us down the long boulevard. "I know how we can get into the Vatican," said Father De Soya, and turned back toward an alley opposite the Vatican Boulevard. "Good," said Ania, following quickly.
The Jesuit stopped suddenly.
"I think that I can get us in," he said, "but I have no idea how to get us out."
"Just get us in, please," said Ania. The steel door was at the rear of a ruined, windowless stone chapel 3 blocks from the Vatican. It was locked with a small padlock and a large chain. The sign on the sealed door said, "Tours on alternate Saturdays only. Closed during Holy Week. Contact Vatican Tour Office, 3888 Square of the First Christian Martyrs."
"Can you break this chain?" Father De Soya asked me.
I felt the massive chain and the solid padlock. My only tool or weapon was the small hunting knife still in my belt sheath.
"No," I said, "but maybe I can pick the lock. See if you can find some wire in that garbage module there. Baling wire would do."
We stood there in the drizzle for at least 10 minutes, with the light fading around us and the sound of traffic on nearby boulevards seeming to grow louder, waiting every minute for the Swiss Guard or security people to swoop down on us. Everything I had learned about picking locks had come from an old riverboat gambler on the Cons, who had turned to gambling after the Port Romance authorities had removed 2 of his fingers for thieving. As I worked, I thought of the 10 years of odyssey for Ania and me, of Father De Soya's long voyage to this place, of the hundreds of light-years traveled and tens of thousands of hours of tension and pain and sacrifice and terror.
and the goddamn 10-florin lock would not budge. Finally, the point of my knife broke. I cursed, threw the knife away, and slammed the stinking, lousing, cretinous piece of shit lock and chain against the grimy stone wall. The padlock clicked open. It was dark inside. If there was a light switch, none of us could find it. If there was an idiot AI somewhere controlling the lights, it did not respond to our commands. None of us had brought a light. After carrying a flashlight laser for years, I had left mine behind in my backpack this day. When the time had come to leave the Yggdrasil, I had stepped forward and taken Aenea's hand without a thought to weapons or other necessary items. "Is this the Basilica of St. John Lateran?" whispered Aenea. It was impossible to speak in anything above a whisper in the oppressive darkness. "No, no," whispered Father de Soya. "Just a tiny memorial chapel built near the original basilica in the 21st. He stopped, and I could imagine his thoughtful expression returning. "It is a working chapel, I believe," he said. "Wait here." Aenea and I stood with shoulders touching as we heard Father de Soya moving around the perimeter of the tiny building. Once something heavy fell with the sound of iron on stone, and we all stood holding our breath. A minute later we heard the sound of his hands sliding along the inside walls again and the rustle of his cassock. There was a muffled, "Ah!" And a second later, light flared. The Jesuit was standing less than 10 meters from us, holding a lighted match. A box of matches was in his left hand. "A chapel," he explained. "They still had the stand for votive candles." I could see that the candles themselves had been melted to uselessness and never replaced. But the tapers in this one box of matches had remained for God knows how long in this dark, abandoned place. We joined him in the small circle of light, waited while he lighted a second match, and followed him to a heavy wooden door set behind rotting curtains. "Father Baggio, my resurrection chaplain, told me about this door when I was under house arrest near here some years ago," whispered Father de Soya. "This door was not locked, but opened with a squeal of ancient, unoiled hinges. I believe he thought it would appeal to my sense of the macabre," went on Father de Soya, leading us down a narrow, spiraling stone stairway, not much wider than my shoulders. Aenea followed the priest. I kept close to Aenea. The stairway continued down, then down some more, and then more. I estimated that we were at least 20 meters beneath street level when the stairway ended and we passed through a series of narrow corridors into a wider, echoing hallway. The priest had gone through a half dozen matches by this point, dropping each only after it had burned his fingers. I did not ask him how many matches were left in the small matchbox. "When the church decided to move St. Peter's and the Vatican during the Hegira," said de Soya, his voice loud enough now to empty in the black space, "they brought it en masse to Pochum, using heavy field lifters and tractor field towers. Since mass was not a problem, they brought half of Rome with them, including the huge Castel Sant'Angelo and everything under the old city down to a depth of 60 meters. This was the 20th century subway system." Father de Soya began walking down what I realized was an abandoned railway platform. At places, the ceiling tiles had fallen in, and everywhere except on a narrow pathway, there were centuries of dust, fallen rocks, broken plastic, unreadable signs lying in the grime, and shattered benches. We went down several corroded steel stairways, escalators halted more than a millennium ago, I realized, through a narrow corridor that continued downward along an echoing ramp and then onto another platform. At the end of this platform, I could see a fiber-plastic ladder leading down to where the tracks had been, where the tracks still were, under the layers of dust, rubble, and rust. We had just climbed down the ladder and stepped into the subway tunnel when the next match went out. But not before Aenea and I had seen what lay ahead. Bones. Human bones. Bones and skulls stacked neatly almost 2 meters high on either side of a narrow passage between the rusted tracks. Great heaps of bones, the socket ends out, skulls neatly placed at meter intervals or arranged in geometric designs within the knobby walls of human bones. Father DeSoya lit the next match and began striding between the walls of skeletal human remains. The breeze of his motion flickered the tiny flame that he held aloft. After the Seven Nations War in the early 21st century, he said, his voice in a normal conversational volume now, the cemeteries of Rome were overflowing. There had been mass graves dug all around the suburbs of the city and in the large parks. It became quite a health problem, what with the global warming and constant flooding. All of the bio and chem warheads, you know. The subways had ceased to run anyway, so the powers that be authorized a removal of the remains and their reinterment in the old metro systems. This time, when the match burned out, we were in a section where the bones were stacked 5 layers high, each layer marked by a row of skulls, their white brows reflecting the light, but the sightless sockets indifferent to our passing. The neat walls of bones went back for at least 6 meters on either side and rose to the vaulted ceiling 10 meters above us. In a few places, there had been a small avalanche of bones and skulls, and we had to pick our way over them carefully. Still, there was the crunching underfoot. We did not move during the interludes of darkness between matches, but waited quietly. There was no other noise, not the scurry of rats nor the drip of water. Only our breathing and soft words disturbed the silence here. Oddly enough, said Father DeSoya, after we had gone another 200 meters, they did not get the idea from Rome's ancient catacombs, which lie all about us here, but from the so-called catacombs of Paris, old quarry tunnels deep under that city. The Parisians had to move bones from their overflowing cemeteries to those tunnels between the late 18th to mid-19th centuries. They found that they could easily accommodate 6 million dead in just a few kilometers of corridors. Ah, here we are. To our left, through an even narrower corridor of bones, was a path with a few boot marks in the dust, leading to another steel door, this one unlocked. It took all three of us to leverage the door open. The priest led the way down another set of rusting spiral stairs, to a depth I estimated it being at least 35 meters beneath the street above. The match went out just as we stepped into another tunnel. Much older than the subway vault, its edges and ceiling unfinished and tumbled down. I had caught a glimpse of side passages running off, of bones spilled haphazardly everywhere in these passages, of skulls upside down, of bits of rotted garments. According to Father Baggio, whispered the priest, this is where the real catacombs begin, the Christian catacombs, which go back to the 1st century A.D. A new match flared. I heard a rattle in the matchbox that sounded like very few matches indeed. This way, I would guess, said Father DeSoya, and led us to his right. We're under the Vatican now, whispered Aenea a few minutes later. I could feel her impatience. The match flared and died. Soon, soon, said DeSoya in the darkness. He lit another one. I heard no rattle in the box. After another 150 meters or so, the corridor simply ended. There were no tumbled bones here, no skulls, only rough stone walls and a hint of masonry where the tunnel ended. The match went out. Aenea touched my hand as we waited in the darkness. I am sorry, said the priest. There are no more matches. I fought back the rise of panic in my chest. I was sure that I heard noises now. Distant rat feet scurrying at the least, boots on stairs at the worst. Do we backtrack? I said, my whisper sounding far too loud in the absolute darkness. I was sure that Father Baggio said that these catacombs to the north had once connected to the older ones under the Vatican, whispered Father DeSoya. Under St. Peter's Basilica, to be precise. Well, it doesn't seem to, I began and stopped. In the few seconds of light before the match had gone out, I had glimpsed the relative newness of the brick wall between stones, a few centuries old as opposed to the millennia since the stone had been cut away. I crawled forward, feeling ahead of me until my fingers found stone, brick, loose mortar. This was hastily done, I said, speaking with only the authority I had gained as an assistant landscape worker on the Beek Estates years and years before. The mortar's cracked, and some of the bricks have crumbled, I said, my fingers moving quickly. Give me something to dig with. Damn, I wish I hadn't thrown away my knife. Aeneas handed me a sharp-edged stick or branch in the dark, and I was digging away for several minutes before I realized that I was working with a thigh bone broken at one end. The two of them joined me, digging with bones, scrabbling at the cold brick with our fingernails, until the nails broke and our fingers bled. After some time at this, we paused to pant and catch our breath. Our eyes had not adapted to the darkness. There was no light here. "The mass will be over," whispered Aeneas. The tone in her voice made it sound like a tragic event. "It is a high mass," whispered the priest, "a long ceremony." "Wait," I said. My fingers had remembered a slight movement in the bricks, not in one or a few of them, but in the entire casement. "Get back," I said aloud. "Crawl to the side of the tunnel." I backed myself up, but straight back, raised my left shoulder, lowered my head, and charged forward in a crouch, half expecting to bash my head on the stone and knock myself out. I hit the bricks with a mighty grunt and a shower of dust and small debris. The bricks had not fallen away, but I had felt them sag away from me. Aeneas and DeSoya joined me, and in another minute we had pushed loose the center bricks, tumbled the entire mass away from us. There was the faintest glimmer of light on the other side of the passage, but enough to show us a ramp of debris leading to an even deeper tunnel. We crawled down on our hands and knees, found room to stand, and moved through the earth-smelling corridor. Two more turns, and we came into a catacomb as roughly hewn as the one above, but illuminated by a narrow strip of glow tape running along the right wall at belt height. Another 50 meters of twisting and turning, always following the main passage illuminated by glow tape, and we came into a wider tunnel with modern glow globes set every 5 meters. These globes were not lit, but the ancient glow tape continued on. "We're under St. Peter's," whispered Father DeSoya. "This area was first rediscovered in 1939, after they buried Pope Pius XI in a nearby grotto. The excavations were carried on for another 20 years or so before being abandoned. They have not been reopened to archaeologists." We came into an even wider corridor, wide enough for the three of us to walk side by side for the first time. Here the ancient rock and plastered walls with the occasional marble inset were covered with frescoes, early Christian mosaics, and broken statues set above grottos in which bones and skulls were clearly visible. Someone had once placed plastic across many of these grottos, and the material had yellowed and opaqued to make the mortal remains within almost unviewable. But by bending and peering, we could see empty eye sockets and pelvic ovals peering back at us. The frescoes showed Christian images: doves carrying olive branches, women drawing water, the ubiquitous fish, but were next to older grottos, cremation urns, and graves offering pre-Christian images of Isis and Apollo, Bacchus welcoming the dead to the afterlife with great overflowing flagons of wine, a scene of oxen and rams cavorting, another with satyrs dancing. I immediately noticed the likeness to Martin Silenus and turned just in time to catch Aeneas' knowing glance. And still more with beings Father DeSoya described as maenads, some rural scenes, partridges all in a row, a preening peacock with feathers of lapis chips that still caught the light in bright blue. Peering through the ancient mottled plastic and plastic glass at these things made me think that we were passing through some terrestrial aquarium of death. Finally, we came to a red wall at right angles to a lower wall of faded, mottled blue, with the remnants of graffiti in Latin still visible. Here the sheet of plastic was newer, fresher, and the small container of bones within quite visible. The skull had been set atop the neat pile of bones and seemed to be regarding us with some interest. Father DeSoya went to his knees in the dust, crossed himself, and bent his head in prayer. Aeneas and I stood back and watched with the quiet embarrassment common to the unbeliever in the presence of any true faith. When the priest arose, his eyes were moist. According to church history and Father Baggio, the workers uncovered these poor bones in 1949 A.D. Later analysis showed that they belonged to a robust man who died sometime in his 60s. We are directly under the high altar of St. Peter's Basilica, which was built here because of the legend that St. Peter had been interred secretly at just this spot. In 1968 A.D., Pope Paul VI announced that the Vatican was convinced that these were indeed the bones of the fishermen. The same Peter who walked with Jesus and was the rock upon which Christ built his church. We looked at the silent heap of bones and then back at the priest. Federico, you know that I am not trying to bring down the church, Ania said. Only this current aberration of it. Yes, said Father de Soya, wiping his eyes roughly, leaving muddy streaks there. I know that, Ania. He looked around, went to a door, opened it. A metal staircase led upward. There will be guards, I whispered. I think not, said Ania. The Vatican has spent 800 years fearing attack from space, from above. I do not believe they give much thought to their catacombs. She stepped in front of the priest and started quickly but quietly up the metal steps. I hurried to follow her. I saw Father de Soya glance back toward the dim grotto, cross himself a final time, and follow us up toward St. Peter's Basilica. The light in the main basilica, although softened by evening, stained glass and candlelight, was all but blinding after the catacombs. We had climbed up through the subterranean shrine, up past a memorial basilica marked in stone as the Trophy of Gaius, through side corridors and service entrances, through the anteroom to the sacristy, past standing priests and craning altar boys, and out into the echoing expanse at the rear of the nave of St. Peter's Basilica. Here were scores of dignitaries not important enough to have been awarded a place in the pews, but still honored by being allowed to stand in the rear of the basilica to witness this important celebration. It took only a glance to see that there were Swiss Guard and security people at all the entrances to the basilica and in all the outer rooms with exits. Here at the back of the congregation, we were inconspicuous for the moment. Just another priest and two somewhat underdressed parishioners allowed to crane their necks to see the Holy Father on Holy Thursday. Mass was still being celebrated. The air smelled of incense and candle wax. Hundreds of brightly robed bishops and VIPs lined the gleaming rows of pews. At the marble altar rail before the Baroque splendor canopy of the throne of St. Peter, the Holy Father himself knelt to finish his menial work of washing the feet of 12 seated priests, 8 men and 4 women. An unseen but large choir was singing. O Holy Ghost, through thee alone know we the Father and the Son. Be this our firm unchanging creed, that thou dost from them both proceed, that thou dost from them both proceed. Praise be the Lord, Father and Son, and Holy Spirit with them one, and may the Son on us bestow all gifts that from the Spirit flow, all gifts that from the Spirit flow. I hesitated then, wondering what we were doing here, why this endless battle of Aeneas had brought us to the center of these people's faith. I believed everything she had taught us, valued everything she had shared with us. But 3,000 years of tradition and faith had formed the words of this beautiful song and had built the walls of this mighty cathedral. I could not help but remember the simple wooden platforms, the firm but inelegant bridges and stairways of Aeneas' rebuilt temple hanging in air. What was it, what were we, compared to this splendor and humility? Aeneas was an architect, largely self-trained except for her adolescent years with the Cybert Mr. Wright, building stone walls out of desert rock and mixing concrete by hand. Michelangelo had helped to design this basilica. The mass was almost over. Some of the standing crowd in the rear of the longitudinal nave were beginning to leave, walking lightly so as to not interrupt the end of the service with their footfalls, whispering only when they reached the stairs to the piazza outside. I saw that Aeneas was whispering in Father de Soya's ear, and I leaned against them to hear, afraid that I might miss some vital instruction. "Will you do me one final great service, Father?" she asked. "Anything," whispered the sad-eyed priest. "Please leave the basilica now," Aeneas whispered in his ear. "Please, go now quietly with these others. Leave now and lose yourself in Rome until the day comes to cease being lost." Father DeSoya pulled his head back in shock, looking at Aenea from half a meter away with an expression of someone who has been abandoned. He leaned close to her ear. "Ask anything else of me, teacher." "This is all I ask, Father, and I ask it with love and respect."
The choir began singing another hymn. Above the heads in front of me, I could see the Holy Father completing the washing of the priest's feet and moving back to the altar under the gilded canopy. Everyone in the pews stood in anticipation of the closing litanies and final benediction. Father DeSoya gave his own benediction of my friend, turned, and left the basilica with a group of monks whose beads rattled as they walked. I stared at Aenea with enough intensity to set wood aflame, trying to send her the mental message, "Do not ask me to leave." She beckoned me close and whispered in my ear,
"Do one final thing for me, Raul, my love."
I almost shouted, "No, goddammit!" at the top of my lungs in the echoing nave of St. Peter's Basilica during the holiest moments of Holy Thursday's High Mass. Instead, I waited. Aenea fumbled in the pockets of her vest and came out with a small vial. The liquid in it was clear, but somehow looked heavier than water.
"Would you drink this?"
she whispered and handed me the vial. I thought of Romeo and Juliet, Caesar and Cleopatra, Abelard and Eloise, George Wu and Howard Sung. All star-crossed lovers, suicide and poison. I drank down the potion in one gulp, setting the empty vial in my own shirt pocket, waiting for Aenea to take out and drink a similar potion. She did not. "What was it?" I whispered, not fearing any answer. Aenea was watching the final moments of the Mass. She leaned very close to whisper,
"Antidote to the Pax's birth control medication that you took when you joined the Home Guard."
"What the hell?" I came close to shouting over the Holy Father's closing words. "You're worried about family planning now? Are you out of your goddamn mind?"
She leaned back, her breath warm on my neck as she whispered again, "Thank God. I've been carrying that for 2 days and almost forgot it. Don't worry. It'll take about 3 weeks to take effect. Then you'll never be shooting blanks again."
I blinked at her. Was this blasphemy in St. Peter's Basilica, or just extraordinarily bad taste? Then my mind shifted into high gear.
"This is wonderful news. Whatever happens next, Aenea sees a future for us, for herself, wants to have a child with me."
"But what about her first child? And why do I assume she's doing this so that she and I can... Why would she... Perhaps it's her idea of a farewell present. Why would she... Why..."
"Kiss me, Raul," she whispered, loud enough to make the elderly nun standing in front of us turn around with a severe expression.
I did not question her. I kissed her. Her lips were soft and slightly moist, just as they were the first time we had kissed, standing on the bank of the Mississippi River at a place called Hannibal. The kiss seemed to last a long time. She touched the back of my neck with her cool fingers before our lips parted.
The Pope was moving to the front of the apse, facing each of the two arms of the transept, then the short nave, and finally the longitudinal nave, as he gave his final benediction. Aenea walked out into the main aisle, pushing people gently aside until she was in the open space and striding toward the distant altar.
"Lenar Hoyt!" she shouted, and her voice echoed the 100 meters to the dome above. It was more than 150 meters from where we had been standing to where the Pope now paused in his benediction. And I knew Aenea had no chance of making that distance before being intercepted, but I hurried to catch up to her.
"Lenar Hoyt!"
she shouted again, and hundreds of heads turned in her direction. I saw movement in the arched shadows along the sides of the nave as Swiss Guard leaped into action.
"Lenar Hoyt, I am Aenea, daughter of Braun Lamia, who traveled to Hyperion with you to face the Shrike. I am the daughter of the John Keats Cybrid, whom your core masters have twice killed in the flesh."
The Pope stood as if transfixed, one bony finger raised in benediction a moment before, now pointing, shaking as if palsied. His other hand clutched his vestments above his chest. His mitre trembled as his head bobbed back and forth.
"You!" he cried, his voice high, thin, and weak. "The abomination!"
"You are the abomination!" shouted Aenea. She was running now, shrugging off dark-robed figures that rose from the pews to grab at her. I pulled two men from her back and she ran on. I leaped over a lunging figure and ran at her side, watching the Swiss guard shoving through the crowd. Energy pikes aimed, but hesitant to fire with so many Vatican and Mercantilist dignitaries in the line of fire. I knew that they would not hesitate if she got within 10 meters of the Pope.
"You are the abomination!" she shouted again, running hard now, dodging grasping hands and lunging arms. "You are the Judas of the Catholic Church, Lenar Hoyt, selling its sacred history to the..."
A heavy man in a Pax Fleet Admiral's uniform pulled a ceremonial sword from his scabbard and swung it at my beloved's head. She ducked. I blocked the Admiral's arm, broke it, kicked the sword aside, and threw him halfway down the length of the pew into his subordinates. Colonel Cassad had said that after learning the language of the living, that he had felt the pain he administered to others. I experienced that now, feeling the torn nerves and muscle and shattered bone of my forearm and the collision of my body as the Admiral struck his men. But when I looked down, my forearm was firm and the only penalty was pain. I did not care about the pain. A cordon of priests, monks, and bishops put themselves between Aenea and the Pope. I saw the pontiff clutch his chest more tightly and fall, but several of the deacons standing near him caught him, carried him back under the canopy of Bernini's throne. Swiss guardsmen hurtled into the space at the end of the aisle, blocking Aenea's way with their pikes and bodies. More filled the space behind us, roughly shoving away the onlookers with brutal swings of their pikes. Pack security in black armor and compact repulsor flying belts came hurtling in 10 meters above the heads of the congregation. Laser dots danced on Aenea's face and chest. I threw myself between her and the imminent energy bolts and flesh-hit clouds. The laser beam blinded my right eye as the target dot swept across it. I threw my arms wide and bellowed something, a challenge perhaps, defiance certainly.
"No, keep them alive!" It was a huge cardinal shouting in a bass rumble like the voice of God. A Swiss guardsman rushed at Aenea with his pike raised to stun her with a blow to the head. She threw herself down, slid across the tile, clipped him at his knees, and sent him sprawling toward me. I kicked him in the head and turned to wrestle the pike out of another guardsman's hands, knocking him backward into the crowd and swinging the long weapon at the 5 guardsmen rushing us from the rear. They gave way. A flying security trooper fired 2 darts into my left shoulder. I presumed they were tranquilizers, but I ripped them away, threw them at the flying form, and felt nothing. 2 guards, a large man and a larger woman, grabbed my arms. I swung them through the air until their skulls collided and dropped them onto tile.
"Aenea!"
She was on her feet again, pulling free of 1 guardsman, only to have 2 forms in black armor block her way. The congregation was screaming. The great cathedral organ suddenly screamed like a woman in labor. A security man shot her at 5-meter range. Aenea spun around. A woman in black armor clubbed my darling down, straddling her and pulling her arms behind her. I used my forearm to swat the pack security bitch 5 meters backward through the air. A guardsman clubbed me in the stomach with his pike. A flying security shape zapped me with a neural stunner. Stunners are supposed to work instantly, guaranteed to work instantly, but I had time to close my hands on the nearest guardsman's throat before they stunned me again and then a 3rd time. My body spasmed and fell, and I pissed my pants as all voluntary function ceased, my last conscious sensation being the cold flow of urine down my pant leg onto the perfect tiles of St. Peter's Basilica. I was not really aware of a dozen heavy forms landing on my back, pinning my arms, pulling me away. I did not really hear or feel the crack of my forehead striking tile or the rip it opened from my brow to hairline. In the last 3 or 4 seconds of semi-consciousness, I saw black feet, combat boots, a fallen Swiss guardsman's cap, more feet. I knew that Aenea had fallen to my left, but I could not turn my head to see her 1 last time.
they dragged me away, leaving a trail of blood, urine, and saliva as they did so. I was far beyond caring. And so ends my tale. I was conscious but restrained with neural locks during my trial, a 10-minute appearance before the black-robed judges of the Holy Office. I was condemned to death. No human being would sully his or her soul by executing me. I was to be transferred to a Schrödinger cat box in orbit around the quarantined labyrinth world of Armagast. The immutable laws of physics and quantum chance would execute the sentence. As soon as the trial ended, they shipped me via a Hawking Drive high-G robot torch ship to Armagast system, a 2-month time debt. Wherever Aenea was, whatever had happened to her, I was already 2 months too late to help her when I awoke, just as they finished sealing the fused energy shell of my prison. And for uncounted days, perhaps months, I went insane. And then for more uncounted days, certainly more months, I have been using the scriber they included in my tiny egg of a cell to tell this tale. They must have known that the scriber would be an additional punishment as I waited to die, writing my story on my few pages of recycled microvellum like the snake devouring its own tail, knowing that no one will ever access the story in the memory chip. I said at the beginning of all this that you, my impossible reader, were reading it for the wrong reason. I said at the beginning that if you were reading this to discover her fate, or my own, that you were reading the wrong document. I was not with her when her fate was played out, and my own is closer now to its final act than when I first wrote these words. I was not with her. I was not with her. Oh, Jesus God. God of Moses, Allah, dear Buddha, Zeus, Muir, Elvis, Christ. If any of you exist or ever existed or retain a shred of power in your dead gray hands, please let me die now. Now. Let the particle be detected and the gas released. Now. I was not with her.